Welcome to Fit and Chips Chats, health and wellness advice for women over 40 and beyond with Amanda Thebe. This is a show full of hot topics specifically for hot women. Amanda Thebe is a force of nature for women who are experiencing menopause hell and want to start feeling healthy and fit in their 40s and beyond. Through her very frank articles, podcasts, and hilarious social media presence, she's here to help you with informative advice while making you laugh like a 20-year-old throughout. Her raging fans have called her an unstoppable inspiration, resilient bitch, and one woman called her the over 40 guru to watch in 2017. Please visit us at fitandchips.com. And now, here's your host, Amanda Thebe.
Hello and welcome to this week's episode of Fit and Chips Chat. I'm here with KSD, otherwise known as Krista Scott Dixon. And most people know you as KSD though. So welcome to the show.
Thank you.
I told my group of menopausing so hard women I was speaking to you and they were freaking out with excitement because you're such a relatable person and I know they were excited to have me ask you some questions. So before we get stuck into the show, I'm just going to just give a brief bio on you and you can just add some extra juicy bits if you want. So Krista Scott Dixon, who is a doctor, PhD, has been teaching and coaching for 20 years and has helped thousands of students and clients learn, grow and explore new possibilities in their lives. She's currently the director of curriculum at Precision Nutrition. I'm one of their graduates. I love their philosophy and education. And she's a global leader in coaching and nutrition. A public speaker on nutrition, women's health and fitness, emotional well-being, and also the psychology of behavioral change. The two things I'm really interested in speaking to you about today are the women's health and the psychology of change. It's just become such an important part of my life and I can see the important part of most women's lives through this space. So it's going to be a good conversation today. She's also the author of several books and runs a website called Stumptuous. And that's actually how I very first heard of you, was on your website. I don't even know where I found it because I don't think even Instagram or Facebook was as big when I found you. I mean, it's only 10 years ago, I think, but I just came across it, went to see you speak at Bang Fitness. You did a nutrition talk with your good friend, Kyle. Mm-hmm. Iron. And then I've just delicately stalked you since then, and then I've made you my friend. Like I do, I wore you down. Got you on the show. So welcome again, Krista. Do you want to add anything else to that?
No, I think that was great. That was really good. Well, I feel good about myself now because listen to that. That was nice.
And you've just recently relocated to Vancouver, which is exciting for me because it reminds me of home, all the rain and the dark sky.
Yeah, and the rhododendrons and the azaleas.
And, yeah. Yeah, and the good people and the good mm-hmm. outdoor life. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so I asked Krista on the show today because I wanted to speak about a couple of things. I sat and had a coffee with Krista about, it must have been about 6 months ago now because we were both still in Toronto. And Krista told me all about her experiences through her double menopause, which I'm double perimenopause. Anyway, we'll get into that. And then, and also how it's impacted you and how it's made you sort of reflect on the emotional side of things and the well-being of women. And then we'll get deep into the sciencey bit, I'm so smart, which you know about a little bit more. So can you talk about your experiences and sort of what happened to you through your early menopause, how you then started going back into menses again, and then how you're back into menopause again?
Yeah, well, okay, great question. So I think let me back up just very quickly and just give folks a little bit of a background to how to understand this. So women's bodies are very, very sensitive to stress, to starvation, to, you know, anything that could be kind of constituted as stress. And I think if you're a woman listening to this, stress is probably a constant in your life, right? I've met one or two people recently who didn't actually have stress in their lives. And I was like, wow, that must be a magical universe candy. I know, right?
Candy doesn't exist.
Yeah. I know, right? So stress is something that's a constant in most women's lives in some way or another. And if you are a woman who is active, training hard, trying to eat well, you might be, you know, watching what you eat and all this kind of stuff. And so if you have enough of the pile of stress in your life, your body starts to shut down hormonal production. So to our bodies are like, okay, is there enough energy coming in the form of food? Are we relaxed enough? Is the world safe enough for us to make a baby, basically? And I want to be cautious when I say this. It's not about what we want, what society wants. Evolution has its own agenda, right? Which is to basically make us available to make babies. And that's just how evolution works. So I'm not saying that this is our destiny in any way, but from an evolutionary physiological standpoint, women's bodies are very, very attuned to, can I make a baby? Is it safe? Am I okay? Is this a good time? And so we're very, very conscious of stress. And so what was happening to me in my mid-30s was I had a ton of stress from my job, ton of stress from my life. I was really watching what I ate and being very, very stringent, very restrictive. I was training really hard. I was competing and grappling. So I had a lot of stress from that. And what happened was my mission control in my brain said, you know what? Things are a bit crazy right now. We're going to dial down hormone production. So we're going to dial down your production of estrogen and progesterone. Your body fat is too low. We're not making, you know, clearly this is a starvation situation. Yeah. So we're going to shut the hormone factory down. So that was how I put myself into a premature menopause at in my mid-30s. And that's what's called functional hypothalamic amenorrhea, which basically means mission control in the brain shuts down the baby maker. That's as simple as it is. So I stopped getting my periods. My hormone levels were very, very low. So when I tested them with a blood test several times, they were very, very low. And so effectively, that is what menopause is.
Yeah, it's similar to the amenorrhea that we often hear that some fitness competitors have gone through. Okay.
Exactly. Yeah, very, very much. And for me, this lasted several years. And so I was effectively menopausal at 35, with all of the same symptoms that you would expect. You know, my body shape started to change. I had a lot of crazy mood swings, a lot of anger. Like, I'm not an angry person. I'm very chill usually. So like crazy anger, tons of anxiety, weird stuff like heart palpitations, you know, all of those things that come along with menopause. So I've already gone through it. And then, you know, it took a long time of decreasing that stress in my life, learning to eat properly again, bringing my body fat up. It took a while. And, you know, I have recovered and now I'm in my mid-40s and now we're starting the perimenopause cycle again. But yeah, it was a very, very instructive experience about how sensitive many women's bodies can be to stress. And often when we think we're doing healthy things, we may be pushing the needle a little bit too far.
That was going to be my question to you then. I mean, at the time, you clearly weren't in a self-destructive place, but you were trying to do what you thought was the absolute best thing for your body, right? I mean, the fact that you were clearly under-eating and overtraining.
Yep.
And I was speaking to Jade Tater the other day about that, and he was saying that's one of the things that women tend to do when they think the best thing for my body needs right now is to do these two extremes, when really, you know, we need to be trying to keep this, everything sort of like quite closely knit together, like eat more, exercise more, or eat less, exercise less, but don't put your body under that extra stress.
Yes, especially in a context where the rest of your life is going to have stress. Like, it's one thing if you are an athlete where everything is taken care of for you, right? Like, if you're an athlete training in China where your only job is to just train and eat, basically, you know, most women who are driven to do this are women who are driven to achieve. So what else are you doing in your life? You're achieving, right? You're achieving with your family, with your friends, with your job, with all this other stuff. You're trying to grow and be a good person and write Christmas cards and all this other shit that we do. You know, so very rarely are women training hard and under eating in a context where everything else is supporting their recovery. So basically everything is draining our tank. And the other thing that's interesting too, a lot of women are not trying to under-eat. They're trying to eat healthy, especially women who are vegetarians. But when you eat often a very high-fiber diet or a plant-based diet, that plant-based diet will also absorb your hormones, because some of our hormones are excreted through digestion. So if you're eating like a high-fiber diet thinking it's healthy, for some women, it will suck up enough of your hormones and excrete them that it will also decrease your circulating hormone levels. It doesn't happen to everyone. I'm not saying go vegetarian, you know, go
and start eating too much meat, but
But studies on women who are plant-based eaters, especially vegans, shows that very, very often they are also dealing with low hormone levels and amenorrhea. So
adding to the stress as well, adding to more stress. And in addition to the things you were just saying then, which was pretty interesting, is that, you know, we've got all of these, like, we need as women to look as though we're thriving. So are you saying that we need to, like, look after the family and write the Christmas cards? And then the minute that you don't do those, it just adds to that feeling of, like, failing. And so when you're, for me, as being an overachiever all the time, having small areas where I start failing really hits me hard, whereas before I could just brush them off. And the ability to cope with things not going to plan anymore has been one of the hardest things for me. And yeah, it's something I have to constantly work on.
Yeah, well, and also too, when your hormone levels are low, you become way less able to cope with anything, right? So when your estrogen is low and your progesterone, especially your progesterone, which is, like, sometimes some people call it nature's Valium, right? It's a calming hormone. And when that goes low, it's like your ability to cope with even the tiniest thing. I remember one time I was walking on the street and I was in a low estrogen moment, and this pigeon flew past my head, like really close, like shoof. And my first instinct was to run after it and punch the shit out of it. I was like, give me that pigeon. I'm just going to punch it in its stupid face. And I was like, okay, that's probably not good. That's probably a little too much rage.
That's too much rage. And then you start crying uncontrollably because of the horrible feelings you had towards this pigeon. Has the symptoms experienced now as bad as they were before? Because this is now nature's way of got you going through it rather than it being forced.
Yeah, no. I feel a million times better. I feel really, really good. And so, you know, I'm noticing a bit of the symptoms of perimenopause. So, for example, hot flashes sometimes at certain times in my cycle. I do notice around ovulation, I notice there's a little bit of a mood bump, a bumpiness, a little bit of turbulence in the mood. But they're nowhere near the same. And it's a much more gentle thing. And I think also part of that is, you know, I change my diet as well. So I'm very careful to tell my body, hey, there's energy coming in. And to sort of take a slight diversion, I find that a lot of women, I mean, the keto diet is a thing now, and it's been a thing for like 100 years, right? So it comes in and out of fashion like every 10, 20 years. But, you know, a lot of women are cutting their carbs right now, which is for most women, absolutely the wrong thing to do, because carbs for many women signify, hey, there's enough energy. So for me, bringing up my carb intake was a really big part of making me feel good. And I notice if it dips below a certain level, like if I'm not paying attention or whatever, I start to notice symptoms again. So for me, having it at a good level is really, really important for energy, for hormone production, you know, all that kind of stuff. So that's just sort of a side tangent note there.
I'm the same, and I do tolerate carbs really well. I do tolerate carbs really well, and I find as well that if but it's always my go-to. I mean, I love carbs more than like any I'm not just talking about starches, but like any sort of any carbohydrates. But I know that women are on the keto diet, I just wonder what the long-term effects of something like that would be, especially as they go through perimenopause. And I almost think that it could be harmful for the over-promotion of, and I know it's the latest phase, you know, we've had paleo, now people are doing keto, but that sort of high fat, extra high fat and low carbohydrate, I just can't see how that can help the hormonal stabilization at the moment. It's in so much flux and you really don't know what's coming around the corner. I would think just keeping everything in a really balanced, controlled environment rather than doing any extremes in the diet is going to be the best thing for a woman, right?
Well, that, and also, you know, so there's what you're actually eating, right? Which we can talk about, but there's also how you're eating and how you're showing up to eating. And for so many women, eating is like this process of like brain hamsters, like thinking about it and planning and should I go keto? And oh my God, I ate ice cream. I'm so bad. So there's like this whole factory of shit in your head, self-criticism and anxiety and stress and rigidity and all this kind of stuff, which we know also contributes to stress. In fact, there's wonderful, interesting data showing what's called cognitive dietary restraint, which basically means thinking about dieting and planning on dieting and self-criticism, all that stuff, can knock you out of a normal hormonal cycle as if you were actually dieting, even if you're not. So even if you're getting all the calories that you should be getting and all the food groups that
really?
You should be
getting. So everything that you that's going on, all of the talk that's going on up here directly impacts.
Yes,
wow.
It's not, It sounds like woo-woo, but basically, you know, your mission control cannot distinguish between real stress and perceived stress. And another example of that is what's called perceived social isolation. So if you feel lonely, if you feel separated from other people, disconnected from other people, even if other people are actually around, your body will respond as if there's a threat. So if you're like, thoughts become things, and that's not woo-woo, that is neuroscience, right? Your brain is processing information as if it were real. So if I feel lonely, if I feel stressed, if I feel self-critical, my brain doesn't know the difference between the critic in my head and a critic standing outside me or something else about to attack me. So if we are consumed with thoughts of dieting and all this stuff, our bodies will respond as if we were actually dieting. Now, combine thoughts of dieting with actually dieting, and you can see it starts to become a bit of a dumpster fire.
And so this, how we actually then is, I mean, I know that that's one of the models in precision nutrition, and it's how I actually coach my clients as well. I mean, it's a huge thing. It's like how, and even just when you're eating the food, about just being mindful about eating it as well. But what's one of the sort of like first steps you would say to a woman if this is what's going on in her mind? How would you tell her to sort of like re-approach eating?
I like to start with gathering data to say, before we change anything, what is going on? So let's look at your whole life. Let's look at what is happening in your family. What is happening with your partner, if you have one? What is happening with your school, if you're going to school, if with your work, or, you know, whatever is going on in your life, with your dog, right? So let's look at all of the domains of your life. What is happening there? How are all of those domains feeling? What domains are feeling great? Maybe your relationship with your partner, if you have one, is awesome. That's very sustaining, very supporting. Maybe your relationship at work is garbage. Maybe you hate your job or whatever. So it's like, okay, let's look at all the domains of your life, first of all, and see how those are going. And then let's look at your eating and your food and your exercise and your body stuff and assess, how are you showing up to that? Where do you feel good? Where do you struggle? Where are you self-critical? Where do you feel lost? Where do you feel disconnected? Let's get a full map. Yeah,
the whole picture.
Whole thing.
Yeah.
And then look at where you might want to intervene. So the first step before you change anything is paying attention, because most of us don't pay attention. We're just so freaking busy that we don't pay attention to what is happening. We're just trying to get stuff done. And I mean, you know, having moved recently, I can totally relate, because I'm sitting, you can't see this outside the camera, but I'm sitting in a pile of boxes.
Me too, actually. I just have them in a different room, but it's crazy. And they can seem overwhelming, right? You can look at them and go...
Well, it's, you know, for me, it's more like I have to get her done. And so this week or last couple of weeks, I haven't focused on, you know, my fitness, on eating. Well, like, I've tried to cover the bases and sort of, you know, tick my boxes of my basic good habits. But my focus has been, I got to get some stuff done.
Yeah.
So I can't take the time to really, you know, pay attention to me in a really substantive way. I can follow my good habits. That's what they're there for, right? To keep us together in times of stress. But I got to get stuff done. Shit needs to be handled. And for a lot of women, that feeling, now my feeling is temporary. It's going to be done in a week, right? Once I get everything unpacked. But for a lot of women, that feeling is constant. You just go from thing to thing to thing to thing to thing to thing. And the kid's just barfed, and the dog's just done this, and your partner's just done this, and your boss wants this. And, you know, so most of us live our lives in this state of constant just trying to handle our shit.
Yeah.
And we tend not to have that space and time to just pause and reflect. And so when I talk to women, our first step is eating slowly. And they're like, I can't do that. I literally don't have 30 seconds to pause and take a breath. Or that's how it feels. I mean,
that's how it feels.
Yeah, they don't. And so, you know, pausing is the next step. So, you know, assess, pause, see if you can slow down a tiny bit. That's the first, and that for a lot of people is huge before you change anything.
A game changer, yeah. And it's funny because I do eat slowly, and maybe I've always eaten slowly, or maybe it's because I've done precision nutrition now. I think it's just like this my sixth year, because I've had to do two resets. It's every 2 years, I think, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
I think so. And I do eat really slowly, and my husband can, he's like a snake. He just opens his mouth and swallows it whole. And I end up looking over going, how do you even how do you even do that? Like, I just don't get it. And I know I don't overeat because I eat slowly. And that's obviously the knock-on effect of eating slowly as well, is that you just start to pay attention to the food and how it feels and how your body feels as well. And it's just, but I think what, reading between the lines, it's the eating slowly is the just being present and paying attention and just acknowledging what's happening right now.
Yes, exactly. And also too, when you start to eat slowly and pay attention, you don't need as many food rules because you know what feels good and doesn't feel. And you know that when you eat something 3 hours later, how do you feel? Right? You're like, oh, you start to put the pieces together. So I don't need to tell you, don't go and eat an entire cheesecake with a pizza on top of it, right? Because you know that 3 hours after that, you're going to be like, oh, I don't feel so good, right? Or if you eat this amazing, you know, pile of vegetables with some protein, you're going to feel energized, right? So you start to notice, I don't have to tell you that anymore. When you eat slowly and you slow down and you sense into those cues, you intuitively start to gravitate towards what makes you feel good, because you start to learn cause and effect. But we're not paying attention. We don't have cause and effect. We don't know why we feel shitty. We just feel shitty. We're like, oh, I feel shitty. There's no sense of like what led to it, because we can't see the relationships between them.
Mm-hmm. And do you feel that something like journaling is a good way to do this? Or even just, I'm a list person. I have like clipboards and pieces of paper with lists and sublists and sublists and lists of my lists in other rooms. But I feel as though like I can't even start the day without just like going, this is what needs to happen today. Even if I don't get through the list, it's just like a take stock moment. Mm-hmm. But what about as far as like writing down like what they're feeling in that moment and just acknowledging?
Absolutely. Write it down, draw it. I've had clients that actually have narrated a meal into their phone, like as they're eating, they're just talking like stream of consciousness about what's happening. Like, oh, I'm taking a bite of yogurt. Okay, this is what I'm noticing. And so it depends if you're a talky person, if you're a writey person, if you're a film yourself, take a picture kind of person, you know, whatever. But somehow, getting it out of your head and into something else or onto something else is amazing. I have clients who doodle things, right? I have lots of clients who like to draw, and they'll doodle like they're monsters, right? They'll be like, oh, I've been overeating and it feels like a monster inside of me. I'm like, cool. Draw the little monster, or draw your little self-critic monster. So if you're someone who likes to draw, like that's perfect. So drawing, writing, taking pictures, you know, saying stuff, taking video, whatever, but just get it out of your head and into something or onto something. Talk to a person. Sometimes just talking to a person. There's a programmer I know who has a rubber ducky on his desk, like above his monitor. And if he's having a tough problem in programming, he'll talk to the duck. There you go.
Yeah. I have three. Don't ask me why, you know. I've got a Christmas hat on. Don't ask me anything, any whys.
Do you talk to them? Because this guy talks to them. Like, he'll talk through the problem with the rubber duck. And the process of just saying stuff out loud will make him.
I might start.
There you go.
Yeah.
See?
Awesome. When you sat on your own all day like a programmer and you've got nobody else to talk to, make friends with the rubber ducky.
Yeah. So basically just get stuff out of your heads to somewhere else, whether that's talking, writing, whatever. And that's a big thing. And when you keep a record over time, like I've gone back to, I found the other day I was unpacking, like packing my stuff to move, and I found a journal from 2012 in which I'd written down all the stuff I worried about. And it was 2 pages of 8.5 by 11, single space, like small font, just like worries and worries and worries. And it was like random shit, like, are my teeth going to fall out? And have I made enemies? Like, it was bizarre. And I was reading it. I was like, that's crazy. But it also showed me how far I'd come.
I was going to say, did you do that? Did you reflect on those? And could you cross a whole load of those off?
Everything. I was just like, why was this a thing? Right. And so it also helps you see the evolution of your thinking over time. Because we forget, we think we'll remember, but we totally forget. And sometimes we find that thing that we wrote, we're like, who wrote this in my handwriting, in my notebook?
Yeah.
So that's really, really helpful too, to see progress, because, you know, you see yourself every day. And so it's hard to notice progress a lot of the time. Whereas someone who sees you once a year may be able to say, wow, you've really changed. And you're like, oh, really?
Yeah, you took the words out of my mouth, actually, because I was just going to say that, you know, when you go and see your relatives again, they go, wow, you look completely different. And you often don't see it in yourself for sure. And that's why I know that like the progress pictures often work for people, but I know that they're important. But for me, I think growth mindset is
huge.
Bigger, but just harder to recognize, right? It's only when I have conversations with other people that I haven't seen for a while, and I maybe listen to the way I'm speaking, and I hear that my voice is saying different things that I maybe wouldn't have said a year ago. That's how I've noticed that I've changed. But it's interesting, the journaling. And I think that I recommend people do it, and I don't do it myself. It's one of, but I'm visual. I take lots of pictures. So I can just even just look at myself and just look at the picture and remember how I was feeling that day, you know, those recollections.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That sort of helps. So I wondered if we could go to a little bit more sciencey stuff. If you can recall the conversation we had, and I was just in the coffee shop, and I was talking about, you know, how one of the problems with women is they tend to start having some fat gain, and then how they deal with that emotionally. We had the conversation about how the fat gain can be a healthy thing for our hormones. For good hormonal health, we do need an element of fat. And I wonder if you could just explain, like, the process, what happens. Mm-hmm. And I sent you a little picture of, like, the boobies turning into shriveled boobies, how not producing our estrogen anymore, and our ovaries turn into raisins. And
well, you know, it's funny too, because I think it's really only a problem in 2017 when we conceptualize having body fat as a problem, right? Yes. Because in evolutionary terms, fat is this wondrous substance that, like, everything in evolution has to earn its rent, basically. Unless it's like some freebie that isn't really bothering anybody, right? But generally with evolution, there's either some advantage to something or it hasn't been selected against. And, you know, fat, like, most women have at least 20% of their body being fat. Generally, it's more like 25, 30, 35%. So there's some reason for us to be a quarter to a third fat, right? There's got to be some thing that this stuff is doing. And so, you know, body fat has this very interesting role, and we're learning more and more. We used to just think it was like a storage depot, like stuff just went there and was like a warehouse and didn't really do anything. Mm-hmm. But fat is actually a very active endocrine organ, which is to say it's like it's a hormone producing substance, and it's a very active, like, with cell signals, little signals going back and forth. And so fat is not this thing that's on your body that's like icky and just a place where stuff is stored. It's an active sensing, dynamic, responding tissue. And so it secretes hormones. It responds to hormones. It signals the body how much energy you have. So there's a lot of crosstalk between the fat on your butt and your brain, because the fat on your butt is telling your brain, hey, this is how much energy we have available. So I think that's really important to frame it that way, because fat is there for a reason. It's what makes us juicy and sexy and curvy and all that kind of stuff, and snuggly and soft, and gives us something to sit on, which is great. So as we age, our hormone production obviously declines. So our ovarian hormone production declines. Okay. So our ovaries are making fewer hormones and less of them. So our body fat sort of picks up the slack a little bit to produce some of the hormones that we need. Now, it doesn't do as great a job as ovarian production. It produces slightly different types of estrogen. It has different effects. But basically, having more body fat is the body's way of preserving, in a sense, that hormone production when the gonads, the ovaries, aren't doing it.
I remember you saying, don't fight the body all the time. It's smarter than you.
Totally. Totally. You know, 2 million years of evolution, at least for just humans, there's something really important happening here. So, having body fat is only a problem in a social context where body fat is despised and looked down on, and where our role models are women who are lean in a way that, you know, would normally have signified starvation, right? So, So I feel like I want us to start by reconceptualizing what our body is doing, because I think it's so easy to feel like my body is against me, like it's out to get me, it's fucking me over, it's being an asshole. And I always say to women, like, if that's how you think about your body, no wonder it's against you. Like, what if you had a neighbor that every time you went out to see, you know, and they were out in the yard, you were like, fuck you, I hate you. Like, how would that neighbor interact with you, right? They would throw their beer cans on your lawn and whatever. So if that's the relationship you have with your body, of course it's going to feel shitty and your body is going to be against you because you're against it. Whereas if you had a different relationship where you're like, okay, body, you know, you and I are in this together. We're partners on the journey. You're my best friend on this road right now. You're all I have, in a sense, to get me through this. For me, that's a different conceptualization. So when I notice fat gain occurring, I'm like, all right, evolution is doing its thing. And it's fascinating, actually, to see how the body regulates itself. Now, obviously, we want to keep it within a healthy range, right? I'm not saying that having 60% body fat is like the best. There's, you know, biology and physiology is all about sweet spots, right? Having this range in the middle that is good for you. And for every woman, it's different. Some women are a little bit, you know, run a little bit softer. Some women run a little bit leaner. You know, Amanda, you're someone who's a little bit more like a whippet, you know, kind of like a leaner, more sinewy kind of body type. So you're not going to need as much body fat, probably.
But I do, I have put body fat on and I just love the way that you've just spoke about fat there, fat being this fabulous part of our body. And I love the idea of embracing it purely from health reasons as well. Like, not just from how we accept our body, but accept it because it's the right thing for your body. I mean, I know that when I look at women that are very, very lean, the one thing I look at them now is think, God, are you going to be in like agony when you go through like all of these changes? Are you going to really like suffer because you're so thin and there's no fat? I mean, I just actually wonder those things now rather than just go, wow, I wish I looked like that. I now wonder what the problems are going to be associated with being too lean.
Well, and that's a great point, right? I like to play the long game. And so, you know, being extremely lean in survival terms is not a great strategy. And the other thing about body fat is it signifies not just how much energy is available, but these signals are also involved in building other tissues too, right? So your bone density is partially controlled by some of these signals. Bone is a very active tissue. It's not just like a bunch of sticks that holds you together. It's an active metabolic tissue. And so when energy availability is low, when you're, you know, again, overtraining, under eating, whatever, those bones aren't getting built either. And, you know, we know that our time to build peak bone density is in our, you know, 20s and 30s. After that, it's probably not going to get any better. So you need to throw everything at it. And of course, you know, if you've gotten to 40, 50 and you've neglected that, it's not too late. It's not like you're screwed. But, you know, leanness has systemic effects everywhere in your body, your brain health, your digestive health, like all of these things, your sexual health. Let's talk about that, right? Because so many women, I talk to them about pleasure and joy and sexuality, and they're just like, what? Like, it's not even on their radar. But body fat is also what keeps us juicy and sexual and, you know, secretes all those hormones that are good for loving. That's a part of healthy aging too, is maintaining the pleasure and the joy. And you and I were talking just before I came on about how as you get older, you give fewer fucks about things. You know, this is a perfect time in your life to enjoy things as you age, right? So to circle back around to body fat, I think the obsessive pursuit of leanness for women is the wrong path. I think get it in a healthy range, not too little, not too much, and let it do its thing. And whatever the shape is, whatever the feel of it is, you know, it's let it do its thing because that's what your body needs. Let it be juicy. Let it be soft. Let it be squishy.
For me as well, like the changes are probably not as obvious to people, but they're obvious to me. But I am not so disappointed in it. I actually thought, when I was pregnant, I actually hated the way I looked and felt the whole time because it made me feel big. It just, and it just was one of those, I just didn't want people to recognize I was pregnant. It was this, I know other people feel this way and I couldn't quite work out why. It's because it just felt so alien to me. But like, this type of weight gain has been interesting for me because I've got boobs that actually feel like quite full. They've never felt full since I was 18. I've got a little bit of a soft belly and I don't hate it, actually. I think it looks quite nice because I've got a little bit of shape now there. You know, like it's not so disappointing for me. And I actually was dreading it. I'm probably only like 5 pounds heavier than I've ever been, but you can tell. You know, it's different on me. I still want to have ripped arms though, but that's fine. You know, like this.
We all do. We all ripped do. We all look like Vasquez from Aliens, right? Completely jacked and whatever. And, you know, you're also making an interesting point, which is that, like, we're used to the concept of puberty, right? As, you know, like being teenagers, okay, then you have to learn to be in a new body. But I think we don't consider as much that you have to learn to be in a new body as we age. And that might be every decade or every 5 years, you know, like when I was in my mid-30s, like I said, I was super ripped and training hard and at the peak of athletic accomplishment for me, relatively speaking. But, you know, but now at 44, my body is different. And every 5, 10, whatever years, we have to learn to be in a different body. And so a lot of women will get frustrated. They'll be like, well, I used to be like this. I used to be able to do this. I used to feel like this. That's not what's happening right now. Now, you may get back there. You may, let's say this is a temporary setback, and you may have that deadlift glory days again, or you may be able to do all those pull-ups again. Who knows, right? But there's going to be a point in your life when your body changes and you have to learn to live in a new body. Whether that's because your shape has changed, your weight has changed, maybe you got injured, you have a chronic health issue, you're going through a different hormonal situation, you've had a baby, you know, whatever it is. But you have to go through all of these different, almost like puberties, over and over and over again. And if you get pissed off because, you know, I actually had a client who was 18 and she was mad because she didn't have a 13-year-old body, right? She didn't have that sort of tall, cultish, long-leggedy, no body fat, 13-year-old puberty body. And I was like, yeah, this is a new body. So you got to get used to it. And so we have the same feelings at every age as our body changes. So at every stage, you're moving to a new house. So you got to get to know the house and love the house and not be mad because this house is not like the other house. It's just how it is.
How it is. And I've mentioned this before to other people when I've spoke to them that I think that it's probably as well a lack of awareness about what's going to happen. I mean, we know about puberty because we were educated about that in schools, and we know about pregnancy because it's very well documented and there's so much information out there. We know what's even gonna change down to the shape of our nipples these days, right? But puberty, it feels like a puberty again for me, but menopause comes along and it's like this, we have these stereotypical ideas of it being like only happening to curly haired old grannies doing their knitting, and it's not someone who looks like you or I. You know, I feel like we're too young for this to be happening. And then the only thing we ever hear is that you're going to get hot flashes. You don't know all of the other stuff that hits us. And so it is harder to accept the new body because it's like, what the heck is this? And another thing I've got to cope with. But I think the coping is the thing that has helps us women just build our characters even more and more. For me, it's made me so much stronger mentally than I've ever been. I'm so defiant now. Like if I read another article saying, you don't have to train different over 40 women, just carry on doing what you were doing, no excuses, no pain, no gain. I'm just calling bullshit on that now because these people haven't looked into the big picture and it's not okay. Right. Yeah. So I think that that's what's happened to women in general. They were just like, nope, I don't agree. It's not like that. And standing up to their husbands and their kids. And I love it. I feel like this is like a new dawn for us.
Yes. And I'm so glad you're framing it this way, because for me, you know, I have found that the conventional narrative of aging, you know, if you read books about menopause or whatever, it's like, here's a bunch of horrible things that are going to happen to you and you just have to deal with it. Fuck. Like, do I want to spend the next several decades? I'm only 44, so I'm hoping I got like 50 more years of me, right? Do I want to spend the next 50 years of my life thinking about how shitty things are? No way. I am experiencing aging as a wonderful process. I would never go back to being in my 20s. The sense of self and strength, and as you said, resilience and courage and character and exploration, you know, that you get from this process is incredible. And I think of it like someone gave me this metaphor, which I love. When hormones change, it's like the tide goes out and you see what is in the tide pools underneath. And all that stuff in the tide pools has always been there, but the tide comes in and goes out and you have these ebbs and flows and you are able to see so much more clearly the truths of your life as you age. And you're kind of forced into it because sometimes you don't want to see those truths. Sometimes you're like, oh God, don't tell me the truth, right? Yeah. But if you embrace the process, it's fucking awesome.
Yeah.
Awesome. It is absolutely awesome.
And I think that that's the way I am with this now anyway. I mean, I'm trying to be. And I wrote an article the other day and I called this like the new warriors of fitness. Like, I just think we deserve more respect than we're getting. We need to stop being underserved. People need to be coming to us for wisdom. All yes. Women through this. Like, instead of being the quiet, invisible women in the background doing all the cooking, or take the time to listen to what we've got to say, because we know our shit and we know life. We get it, right? So I just feel as though this is like the time for us to thrive. And it's like you were saying, there's no point looking in the rearview mirrors anymore. And comparison is the thief of joy, right? I mean, if I were to look back at some of the things I've accomplished, I actually don't want to do them anymore either. I've got new goals, new ideas of things I want to do. And my life looks nothing like it did in its 20s or 30s. And that's fine too.
Yeah, it's a natural evolution. It was funny because I was talking to a friend of mine who was also in her 40s about how this new stage for me, and I've made some massive transitions recently, it feels weird, but okay. And she said, yeah, I think that's, you know, when you're younger, if you're a female, you feel like if you do all the right things, you will have control. And as you get older, you realize you don't have control over most things. And if you embrace that, then it's like you become so much happier. You're like, well, let's just see what tomorrow has. That'll be fun. Like, it's just, you know, each moment unfolds and unfolds and unfolds. And obviously you can take charge of your life and your destiny, but there's so much randomness and so much unexpected stuff that you can also enjoy how things are unfolding, and you can relinquish that control, right? Because when you're younger, sometimes it's like so rigid. You're less like, oh, if I do all the right things, and if I'm a good girl, and if I'm so good to people, and if I make the right job choices, like I have to make all the right choices, because what if I make the wrong choices? And as you get older, you're like, fuck, it's just choices. It's just choices. They're going to have cause and effect and consequences, but it's just choices, and I don't have control over the universe. So I'm going to just let that go.
Yeah. And it's like building up that resiliency and that armor. Like, we just need to do that. And I mean, even though there's going to be days where it's really hard to reflect when you're just feeling so dire, it's hard to be really positive. And on those days now, I feel like I do a positive thing, even though it doesn't feel positive. And that's just to accept that. Like yesterday, I didn't leave the sofa for most of the day because I just was in a very dark place. And then I just went to bed thinking, ah, it's fine because tomorrow I'm going to sort my shit out. Yeah. I did. But I didn't dwell on the past. And I just keep thinking these days are getting less and less because I've got more coping strategies. And something you touched on earlier was these underlying habits. I always have those in place. So most of the time, not all of the time, my nutrition's on point. Most of the time, my fitness exercise is on point. Most of the time, I'm good to myself and other people. And this day is when that doesn't happen. But as long as those ducks are all in a row, my little ducks are in a row, then my rebound is quicker.
Yes.
So that's what I'm aiming for. So I'm going to move on to one more question. And this is from, I put a question out to the Menopausing So Hard group, and there was a woman who trains endurance athletes. Her question was about the impact of endurance training during perimenopause to menopause and beyond till death. Mm-hmm. And she said she's finding that her runners are getting more injured and they're still putting weight on their midsection. And when we pretty much have touched on why that might happen. But what her question was is that she's really struggling to find sort of like studies and data on this. Maybe there aren't any. I'm not sure. If you know any, you can forward us to. But do these hormonal changes impact our ability to sort of have muscular endurance that we know of? Do these hormonal changes have any impact on our why we're getting injured more? Or is that just a cause of like maybe just not having enough support in our lean muscle mass? And it's probably a big whole huge answer to this. I have my thoughts on it too, but I'd like to know from your perspective.
Yeah. Well, one thing to say is that, you know, I touched on bone density earlier. So bone metabolism is a thing. It's an active kind of process. And we do know that ovarian hormones definitely affect it, as do other hormones too. But also connective tissue turnover, right? Inflammation. So if you think about, like, what is injury? Injury is basically the tissues are unable to respond adequately to loading or to stressors, right? And so, if you think of it as a dynamic process, it's like, okay, what stresses are being placed? You know, what's coming in? What are all the inputs and what are all the outputs? What am I expected to do? What am I expected to expend? And are the things in balance, right? So, I mean, a good analogy is something like a bank account. So maybe you're a big spender. You better have a big income. It's fine if you want to be a big spender if you have a big income, right? If you don't have a big income, you have to be more frugal. You have to be more careful. And so with endurance athletics, we are expecting so much of our bodies, right? At a time when our bodies may not have the resources to deliver as effectively. So what that means is what I typically see in a lot of athletes is, and women in general, is they don't fill the bank account. They keep withdrawing and withdrawing and withdrawing, but they don't put that, you know, the stuff back in. And so when I say to them, what are you doing for your recovery? I take a day off. That's not enough. No. You have to, like, that's like saying, I don't take money out of the bank account on a day. But what are you putting in? You're not putting in anything. You know, how are you sleeping? How are you nourishing yourself? Are you doing active recovery, you know, to promote tissue health? Are you de-stressing? How's your emotional health? Like, how's any of that stuff? How are you filling the tank? And a lot of people are like, I don't know.
What are you talking about? They don't look at the whole picture again. It's like looking
exactly.
At the, yeah.
Right. And performance is not about how you train. It's how you recover. That's why, you know, anabolic steroids work. It's how they help you recover so you can train hard, but they also repair you super fast. That's how that works. So you have to ask yourself, how am I promoting recovery, like chasing recovery? Because it's not going to just happen. Just taking a day off from training, that does nothing. I mean, I shouldn't say it does nothing, but you're going to work. You're dealing with all the other shit in your life. That's not recovery. That's just not hammering yourself.
That's just not, just not running again. Yeah.
It's like you didn't pick the scab for a day, right? But you're picking the scab. Of course it's not going to heal, right? So you have to recognize as you go through life, yeah, you can do all the things you want to do, but you have to recognize that there are trade-offs and you have to think about how to balance the pieces. So if you want to train hard, great. You better recover hard. Think about that. You know, how is that going to look for you? How are you going to recover mentally? How are you going to recover emotionally? How are you going to recover physically? If you want to train hard, if you want to be an athlete, go for it. But you have to fill that bank account. If you want to buy that Lamborghini, you've got to have money.
Start saving.
Start saving, right? Start hustling gigs on the side or whatever. And so for me, that's really the fundamental problem is that women and athletes are expecting that bank account to be withdrawn indefinitely, and it cannot be. So again, bone turnover will be affected. Connective tissue turnover and repair will be affected by the change in your hormones. Muscular endurance doesn't really seem to be so affected. You know, there's a slight decline in our ability to produce all the enzymes and stuff like that. There's a slight decline in, you know, mitochondrial efficiency, all that kind of stuff. But that's not as relevant as the structural repair, I would argue. Yeah.
And then food repair. Yeah, and the food. And then in addition to this, it's like you were saying at the beginning about just managing all of your stresses as well. Like just the holistic thing about just making, well, I know that's part of the recovery, but just even when you are running, if you're not in an optimal state to be doing the endurance sport, then, just take stock and just think, well, don't stick to a schedule as rigidly as you previously did if it's not right for you.
Yes.
I know for me, when I've done like things that have completely, say I did a Spartan run and it was awesome and I did it and it was hard. It was 12 miles or something and I wasn't prepared and I wasn't ready. And then it took me 4 days to even just feel normal again, not to start training, just to feel normal again. Whereas previously it would have taken me a day. I wouldn't have cared. And that's the type of like, lessons you need to learn. Just listen to how your body's feeling. The day after you've worked out, are you ready again? You're probably not. Really listen and do everything you can to just get it feeling optimal again.
Yes, yeah. Yes. And also consider the mental state that you have too. Like, it's funny, I've just moved to a neighborhood. I've never seen so many damn runners in my life. Like, I'm just looking at my front window, there's just runners, runners, runners. It's like a marathon every day. It's sort of funny. But almost no one looks like they're having any fun. Right? So I find that endurance athletes tend to suck the fun out of things a lot of the time, right? So they're just like, what is my time? And they're like checking their watch and they're like, oh shit, I was 3 seconds slower. And they have their schedules and they're like, I have to do X number of miles or kilometers today. And, you know, I'm like, okay, look, unless you're getting paid for this, that's not your headspace. And in fact, people who do get paid for this, some of the elite East African runners, don't run like that. They don't think like that. They don't train like that. Why are you doing this? It's because running is fun and it's good to get outside and it feels good to sweat and you're maybe having running buddies and whatever. So when I look outside, I'm like, how many of these people are running joyfully and playfully and with fun and lightness in their steps rather than just like, I got to get this done. So I find that a lot of endurance athletes make this into another chore. You know, it's like, I got to do this. And if we're being honest, a lot of women choose endurance training to stay skinny, right? To try to lose weight. That's, you know, oh, I want to lose weight, I should run a marathon. If we're being honest, like if I polled 100 runners and said, are you running for joy? How many of them would say yes? I used to love running. I can't really do it anymore, but I used to love it. Just the pleasure of being outside and smelling the dirt and hearing my feet. Like to me, it was a very joyful, playful thing. And sometimes I would go out in the alleyway and just take a soccer ball and just run it up and down. And that was super fun. And that was very replenishing. So even your activity itself, what is your mental and emotional state about your activity? Because that will also affect your recovery. So the East African runners, many of them will often run playfully. You know, or if they go out 10 minutes and they're like, it's not feeling good today, they'll turn around and come home. They'll run with partners and have fun and enjoy it. So ask yourself that part of it too. How are you getting, and whether it's running or swimming or weightlifting or anything else, how are you engaging in it? Are you engaging joyfully and playfully? Is this activity replenishing you or is it draining you? Is that something else that's draining you?
Yeah,
that affects it.
Yeah, that's a really great way to look at it. And I love the idea as well, because I mean, I push through. I'll go for a run and think, I can't. It's not there today. But then, and I'll just keep going. And I don't particularly feel any better for doing it. I just felt like that was like a really shit run. Why did I bother? Yeah. And you're saying, well, why did you bother?
Yeah. And sometimes when I have run in the alleyway too, like I'll put on some music and I'll do like little fancy feet drills, right? Like little dances and little fancy feet drills. And like I'll make little games and I'll like run around a tree or something. Like I'll, you know, like make up stupid games in my head or like jump over rocks or something. You know, there's got to be a playfulness to your training because honestly, why the fuck are we doing it? Like why do any of this unless it is a joyful, replenishing, rejuvenating activity? This isn't our jobs. For most of us, right? Because, you know, a lot of professional athletes, for them, you know, at a certain tier, it becomes so much of a job. Once they finish competing, they never do it again. And that seems very sad to me, right? All the joy of it is gone. Mm. How tragic.
Yeah. How tragic. And that's why I always, talking about my children, I never push them in sports. Mm-hmm. I encourage them, but I don't push them because I don't want them to have the joy sucked out of it for them. Yeah. We'll just finish off with one thing, the recovery side of it. I encourage my ladies to walk a lot, to get outside and walk and be out with nature and the squirrels and the chipmunks and things. But we know that that has a great impact on so many areas of our body. What's your thoughts on it?
100%. I 100% support that. And walking is an amazing activity. I love walking. You know, as long as you have 2 feet that work, you can walk, which is great. but also your piece about getting outside is huge, right? We know that that nature, even if it's just a plant or a sunbeam or something like that, is rejuvenating to human beings. There's lots of research showing that when we get out in nature as much as possible, again, even if it's just getting next to a plant, is replenishing and is recovery promoting for us. So if we can even get to a park or a forest or whatever, our blood pressure is going to drop. You know, our stress hormones are going to go down. It's extremely replenishing. So just get outside. You know, when I go to gyms, you know, sometimes we have to go to gyms. We live in Canada. It's winter time. We can't always run outside. It's taking our life in our hands, right?
Well, I'm in Texas now, darling, so it's sunny all the time. Of course.
Yeah, I forgot about that, right? Yeah. But in the land of ice and snow, sometimes if you're trying to run in January, it's just you're just you know, moments away from face planting onto a cement sidewalk. So, you know, sometimes we have to do things inside, and that's okay. But, you know, I've often walked into gyms and just seen these banks of treadmills up against, like, facing a wall. And I'm just like, why would anyone want to do this? Like, sometimes we have to, but why would anyone choose this when we can choose being outside? So I think, you know, your point about getting outside, getting into nature is so crucial, because that is also very, very replenishing. So, you know, part of your recovery strategy as a human being could be 10 minutes in nature, or, you know, take the family for a hike or something like that. But consider nature, like vitamin N, you know, to consider nature and outdoors as part of your overall treatment strategy. Again, whether that's getting out for a walk around the block on your lunch hour and just getting some sun on your face.
My husband works in a bank in downtown Toronto. And when we first got there the first year, I noticed his skin was looking really gray. And I just said, you don't look so good. And he said, oh, I feel fine. And I went, well, it just looks like you've had no sun anywhere. Well, I work from 9 till like 8 o'clock. No, I haven't had any sun. And I went, but when you walk out to get your lunch, don't you sit outside? He went, oh, I use the underground tunnels. I actually don't. So for 6 months, he never got outside. And I was like, okay, things are going to change.
Yeah.
It's crazy. Totally. Yeah, getting outside. And you've just invented a new vitamin, so I love that.
Yeah, vitamin N. Take it every day, as literally as possible. There's no overdose.
So, Kirsty, that was awesome. And I know that this is going to be really helpful to other women listening to this. Where can they find you? What's the best place to search you out? I know you're PN is your job, but is it best off going to you on your Stumptuous?
Yeah, you can find me if you hit Stumptuous on Facebook, you'll find me. If you type in Krista Scott Dixon on Facebook, you will find me. Stumptuous on Instagram, at Stumptuous on Twitter. So, you know, you can find me in lots of places. I'm not super active on Twitter, but you can certainly message me there. Precisionnutrition.com, if you're looking for stuff that I've written, there's tons of free stuff there. Like, that's a great, like, there's, you can spend days reading all the free stuff on precisionnutrition.com. So Facebook and precisionnutrition.com are probably the two best ways. And then, of course, stumptuous.com. You can always go and spend more time reading free stuff.
And then your books as well. I mean, are they available on Amazon?
Yeah. One of the ones about food and eating is called Why Me Want Eat. And you can find that on Amazon. It's, you know, Amazon.com, Amazon.ca, Amazon UK. It's pretty easy to find. So just Google Why Me Want Eat and you should be able to find it.
I love that. And it's the reason that it's such a great book for people to check out as well is because it's a workbook. That's why I really like that book. It's the most unusual self-help book you'll ever read with lots of profanities.
Yes, it has lots of swears and it has places to doodle, and it's definitely not your average self-help book for sure. And you know, I've had people say, like, I'm 10 pages in and I've laughed like, you know, 15 times. So it's funny. It's ridiculous. I think it's pretty insightful. Like, it, you know, people are telling me that they're really cracking a lot of stuff open for themselves with it. So, and it's not available in electronic format. It's only available in print because you have to write in it or draw in it or rip it up or whatever you want to do with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you can burn the book at the end. Is that like totally. a Viking funeral?
Yes. I love that. I'm going to steal that. That's great.
See, I've just given you some wisdom. Who would have thunk it?
Yeah, well, you know, learn from everyone, right? It's mutual.
So thank you for coming on the show, Krista. It's been great to have you. And I will tune out now, everyone. So thanks for coming on. And tune in next week for my next guest. So bye for now, Krista.
Thanks for having me.
Take care. Bye for now.
Thanks for listening to the show. For more information on the services offered by Amanda, please head over to her website at fitandchips.com. That's FITNCHIPS.com. Or her Fit and Chips Facebook page. Leave a comment and she promises to respond to all questions. The views and advice expressed by Amanda Thebe are not a substitute for conventional medical service. No information here should be interpreted as a medical diagnosis, treatment, or prevention of any disease. If in any doubt, always contact your healthcare provider.